Welcome to Season 5 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we are further expanding our knowledge by speaking to experts in the fields of physiology, psychology, nutrition, strength and conditioning, and mindset training. We'll be speaking to the coaches and practitioners who do this every day and to the researchers and academics who are at the forefront of the sciences. Today, our guest is Sam Gilbert. Sam is a registered physiotherapist with the Australian Physiotherapy Association and certified strength and conditioning specialist with the National Strength and Conditioning Association. He holds a bachelor degree in physiotherapy from La Trobe University and a master's degree in exercise science from Edith Cowan University. Sam has combined his practical experience with an in-depth study of sports performance in relation to combat sports and strives to help other combat athletes reach their full competitive potential whilst at the same time decreasing injury risk and increasing competition and training potential. In this episode, we discuss many of the major points of his book, The Science of Striking. There's a lot to get through, so let's get to it. And that green light means we are live yet again back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Now joined tonight by a very special guest, Mr. Sam Gilbert, all the way from Tokyo, Japan. Sam, thanks for coming on, mate.
Jordan, how you doing? Thanks very much for having me.
Very, very well. Thank you for coming on. Now, we were talking a little bit off air there about your journey and how you got to being in Tokyo, and that was probably one of the coolest stories that I've heard before going live on a podcast. So, just to let everyone listening in on that, give us a bit of a background. Let's tell us a bit who you are, what you do, and how you ended up in Tokyo, Japan.
Sure. Yeah, so I grew up in Australia in a town called Ballarat, which for all your international listeners is about 100 k's outside Melbourne. Grew up, you know, playing the normal sort of a sports that Australian kids play. But at the same time was sort of fascinated by what I saw in, in the martial arts movies. Kid who starts karate, you know, grows up watching Van Damme and Bruce Lee. And, whilst my mates wanted to watch Van Damme, I wanted to be Van Damme. I was fascinated not only by the mystique of martial arts and that sort of aura of invincibility and you know, being able to beat up the bad guys, but also the sort of physicality and physical characteristics that these guys had. Obviously, you know, all of these movie stars were chiseled and ripped, and I was fascinated in that as well. And I sort of see it a lot in my 5-year-old son who is obsessed with superheroes at the moment. And I see a lot of me in him. And he's sort of recognizing these biomotor abilities. He doesn't call them that, of course. But, he knows the Hulk is the strongest and the Flash is this speed. And, you know, Superman can lift up a car. But then I pretend to be, Iron Man. It's like, no, Iron Man can't lift up a car. And so this, this fascination with physicality really sort of took hold of me from a young age, and whilst most kids grow out of it, this is something that sort of continued to fascinate me into adulthood. And there's probably a ton of other ways in which I've not matured, but this is probably the one that's been of most interest and most use to me professionally. My mum took me to a karate dojo when I was 8 years old. The style was Kyokushin, which a lot of people sort of recognize for that sort of full contact style of karate, a lot of hard low kicks. The Kyokushin as a style has sort of broken to a lot of different political associations now since the death of the founder, Masayoshi, in 1994. So the style that I practice now is called Shin Kyokushin, but it's basically the same style. It's just under a different organization. Once I started karate, I fairly quickly went from wanting to be a superhero and wanting to be Bruce Lee to wanting to be successful in competition because, depending on where you go, in a lot of places, Kyokushin and Shin Kyokushin is very competition heavy. So we do focus a lot on the sports side. It's not only that, and that's a sort of common misconception. Masayama was a great sort of mixed martial artist decades ahead of his time. I was very focused on that competitive side. So, worked hard on preparing for competition all through my youth. And that involved some degree of, I guess, strength and conditioning. It certainly wasn't very structured at that time. I know my mum had a 1.5 kilo set of dumbbells, which I threw around in all sorts of directions and knew that wasn't enough weight. So I pestered her to buy me some more weights. And then when I was old enough, got to take me to the gym. And started on a proper resistance training program. And I guess sort of parallel to that, I guess secondary to my interest in the human body and in training, decided that I was sort of starting to look towards physiotherapy as a career. We had a family friend who was a physiotherapist, and so I got a bit of exposure to that through some work experience with him. And yeah, I just thought that it was a very good mesh to try and work together the martial arts backgrounds with a study of sports science and rehabilitation. And as much as the mystique around being able to inflict pain on people fascinated me. There was also this mystique around being able to fix people in pain as well, which was interesting and fascinating. So I competed up until, I was 30. I'd always planned on going to Japan. So I guess watching those movies, the Karate Kid was a big movie for me, as it was for every sort of budding martial artist. And especially in the Karate Kid 2, where Mr. Miyagi, it takes Daniel to what was supposed to be Okinawa. Yeah, I think it was Oahu where it was filmed. But that was really cool as well. And ended up being almost 20-30 years later that my wife and I bought a block of land 2 years ago and ended up building a house. And lo and behold, our neighbours living across us were Mr. and Mrs. Miyagi. So it sort of came full circle. But
Wait, back up on that. Back up. You got to elaborate on that a little bit. You can't just drop that on us.
Yeah, it was probably my most shared and liked social media post of that year, whereas I just shared the nameplate of my neighbour, and it was, I guess it was always destined to move across the road from Mr. Miyagi. And a lot of people got a good laugh out of that.
That is awesome.
But a lot of the top fighters in our organization had spent some time in Japan. And so I knew that I wanted to, spend some time training and competing in Japan. After finishing my high school studies, I got a place at La Trobe University where I did my undergrad degree in physiotherapy and decided to defer that placement. Basically, I was looking at a window of 18 months before the next major international competition. And at 18, I wasn't really developed enough to qualify. And I thought that taking that gap year and really working on my training would sort of build me up to the level where I was ready. And so I went and lived in a town called Kochi, which is on Shikoku Island, which is the smallest of the four main islands. Trained there for 6 months, where I probably saw like three other foreigners, was incredibly homesick. And as an 18-year-old, I was getting the crap beaten out of me every day, sometimes up to 8 hours a day of training, which, my body wasn't really used to, which, we can talk a little bit later about, long-term athlete development and training load and how all that's relevant. But I managed to survive and got a lot stronger as a result and ended up qualifying for the World Cup, which was the following year. And then went back to Australia, did my four-year degree in Melbourne. And by that stage, I was 23. I'd already blew my ACL out twice and had two full knee reconstructions. So at that stage, I didn't know how much longer I was going to be able to compete for. And so I really wanted to prioritise my fighting career. And so, made the move to Japan again. And that was the end of 2004. And at that stage, it was 3 years until the next major tournament was the World Tournament, and I would have been 26 at that time. And I thought, 3 years, I'll win a world title and then come back to Melbourne, and that'll be it. I guess we're coming up 16 years at the end of this year, and I'm still here. Retired from competition at 30, so I sort of pushed on a little bit longer than I thought I would. I ended up having a third knee operation, and I sort of got to the stage by that last tournament when I was 30. My peak was when I was 28. I managed to place fourth in the World Cup in our organisation. And then started to slow down a little bit, and I sort of felt like I was ready at that stage to retire. And then, you know, during that time, I was working at an expat physiotherapy practice, treating mainly expats. I was doing a little bit of work with the fighters that I was training with and other people in the organization. And yeah, it sort of got to the stage where I'd outgrown that practice and I'd retired, and it sort of felt like the right thing to do to open up my own practice. And luckily my brother-in-law is a personal trainer, so it sort of made sense for us to try and find a space where we could combine rehabilitation, the training, and also combat sports work under one roof. So we managed to find this amazing 400 square meter facility, which in the heart of Tokyo is pretty hard to do. You know, space is a premium here. And open Club 360, which is a multidisciplinary fitness and rehab centre. We've had this place now for 7.5 years, and we've just opened up our second full-time facility a month before COVID struck, so it was perfect timing. And then at the same time, after I've retired from competition, you know, I've always had obviously an interest in training and strength and conditioning, and I wanted to take that further. So the year after I retired, I enrolled in a master's program at Edith Cowan Uni in Perth, and completed that part-time over 3.5 years. So that sort of broadened my knowledge in strength and conditioning, and also my just ability, I think, to read and interpret, you know, science and just be a bit better in that space as well. So yeah, that basically takes us to the present day. So still here in Japan, and yeah, we'll be here for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Hey, big shout out to our friends at Edith Cowan Uni, in particular Dr. Oliver Barley. He's probably one of the best minds in combat sports nutrition world. And like you just said, like the way that he thinks, I feel, is a little bit different. Maybe that is through the education there, but I've peppered him with many, many, many questions over the years, which he's given me even better answers for.
Yeah, I've loved loved both of the episodes with Oliver. That's great talks. But yeah.
Excellent, excellent. Hey, Sam, I want to ask you something, because I feel like this might be similar to me, where I feel, looking back on say my sporting career or my athletic career when I was younger, and you were obviously very active from, you know, a very young age. I think you said you were 8 when you started karate. 8, so 8 years old. And I often think, wow, the knowledge I know now about diet, I wonder if I would ever have been able to apply that, or why did no one ever tell me to apply that when I was going through as an athlete? Is there anything that kind of jumps out? You said that, you know, when you're 18, you're in Japan, your body wasn't physically ready for that type of training, and then you did the two ACLs. Knowing what you know now, is there anything that you think, okay, maybe when I was younger and I was coming up, were there things that I should have done, or what would present day you have recommended to you going through that program or going through that training mode?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And it's probably a question that I've asked myself a lot, but probably never really answered. And there's so many facets to that question that it sort of, yeah, in a way needs to be taken apart a bit. But yeah, definitely the training load piece was a big one. I think it was very difficult given the circumstances that, yeah, I was training through year 12, where, you know, I was focused more on my studies because, you know, to get into physiotherapy in Australia is very competitive. It's a very popular course. And so I sort of had to put my training a bit on the back burner during my last year of high school. So my training really took a hit. I was still competing. I probably still had, you know, 3 or 4 fights in that year, but yeah, I wasn't really progressing as an athlete, which I was fine with because I just needed to get through that year and do well. And then I guess that probably gave me a month and a half to get ready to go to Japan. And so I did train relatively hard, but there was, you know, there's just no way I could have replicated what I was going into, and I didn't really know what I was going into. So, and also for an 18-year-old to take that step and go and live and train full time, yeah, is a massive thing anyway. So I don't think that it was the coaches that I was under at either end, either my coach in Australia or the coaches that I was going to train under in Japan. But I guess it sort of comes back to the notion of having a minimal effective dose in what you're doing. And I think that that goes for anything. I mean, you obviously know yourself. If you can make changes to someone's body composition by having a certain caloric deficit, and that's all you need to do, then there's no point in doing extra interventions or making something harder than it needs to be. And I think that if you're thrown into an environment where you're 18, you've been training maybe an average of 1 to 2 hours a day, maybe 2 hours a day when I was getting ready for that that stint in Japan, and then suddenly I'm training, 6 to 8 hours a day. That's a massive ramp up in load, and so your body sort of freaked out to a certain point, and you will adapt very quickly, but then you lose that window of adaptation later on. So, there's only so much stimulus you can provide to the system to get it to adapt. And if you use all your stimulus up too early, then you run out of that room for adaptation. And I think that's potentially what happened to me. So I made adaptations very quickly, but I probably, hampered the amount of adaptations I could have made later on in my career because of the way that I was training then. But of course, at that age, I hadn't even started my physio degree, and I didn't know any better. And I still think that going from Australia to Japan, just that move in itself is very difficult, because here in Japan, whether it's in business or in sports or anything, there's just that mentality that more is better. So people will stay in the office, very long hours with very, very low levels of productivity, because that's what you do here. You work hard and you don't really work smart. And I've seen that the whole time that I've been here in terms of, especially in Shinkyokushin Karate, where I see most of that training. But there's a lot of volume, a lot of quantity, but the quality is often missed out on. So there's a lot of factors that went into it, but essentially, I probably was overtrained for most of the time that I was in Japan for that first stint. But because I was coming from such a low base, I was still able to adapt and progress. Specific to the injury, I guess having an understanding of what actually contributes and causes an injury is probably the biggest thing that I would go back and teach a young me. The way I sort of look at injury is that the majority of musculoskeletal injury is due to load. So some sort of loading error. And that loading error will happen in relation to time. So for example, you get a low kick from someone who hits very hard, but they're a little bit slow, and hits you on the side of the leg, but because of that speed, say that kick is delivered in 0.4 seconds. There's a certain amount, and let's say that kick is delivered with 4,000 newtons, for example. That overall load would be, let's say, 10,000 newtons per second. And let's say that is within the tolerance of a certain tissue. Say you get the person who kicks with the same amount of power but kicks a lot faster, so that now that same kick is delivered in 0.2 seconds. That kick is now being delivered with 20,000 newtons per second. So, and that may be, with that combination of load and time, that may be enough to put that structure under enough stress to cause it to fail. So that's just one example at one end of where an acute amount of load is too much for the time that has been applied in. At the other end, you have a load that's applied over a very long period of time. So, you talk about the acute versus chronic workload ratio, which is very popular in other sports, especially team sports. Not a lot of work done in combat sports at the moment, but that's when, say, you increase your training loads too rapidly, and over a course of maybe, as I'd say, training camp over 8 weeks, your body, because of that, the speed and that training load has increased, your body doesn't have the chance to adapt and recover, and again, you get tissue failure. So you see there that that's load overapplied over time, but in two very different cases. So when we talk about load, we can think about all the different things that can cause load on the system. I like to, and I've got a diagram. I didn't have it in the book. This is just something I've sort of put up quite recently, but it's It's on my social media and my website. But basically, if you imagine a Venn diagram with four parts, and you have one part that's a tissue-specific load, so the actual stress that you're putting on a tissue. So again, if we kick someone on the thigh, and let's say that that load is going through to the medial collateral ligament, that specific load is an acute load that's delivered and causing stress to that structure. If we're talking about a overuse injury on, let's say, a hamstring, some repetitive movement that's causing that hamstring to be under excessive load causes it to be overloaded and to cause pain. That's sort of what we call tissue specific. And then we sort of talk about indirect load. So direct load. So we have that direct tissue-specific load, and then we have an indirect tissue-specific load. So let's say someone has very stiff hips or very stiff upper back, and they're having to do a lot of rotary movement. Then if they don't have enough range of motion through the upper back and through the hips, then that's going to cause the lower back to be overloaded. So that indirect load, indirect tissue-specific load, is to do with the biomechanics and the areas around the area that would end up being injured. On the other side, we have a direct load that's what we call systemic stress. So this isn't just the stress on the actual tissue, but we're talking about the overall training load. So how much training volume an athlete's doing that affects their systemic recovery and affects their overall well-being. And this may also apply to psychological stress too. So from a psychological perspective, if someone is under a high degree of psychological stress and anxiety, they may have a lot of nerves over performance in a certain event, then that can all contribute as well. And then down the bottom, we have what I call indirect systemic load. So these are the things like general health, sleep, nutrition. I'm sure you know yourself that when your athletes are malnourished, they're at a higher susceptibility of injury. And then also what I term indirect systemic psychological load is the sort of beliefs around someone's injury and the influence of others, the things that an athlete is being told by the coaches, by the medical practitioners, by their teammates, by the friends and family. That is also another type of load. And so all these different types of load come together to create that total load, which then may be thrown out of whack, maybe overloaded by the time that it's applied in. And so I find that no matter what sort of injury I see, I can always relate it to that sort of paradigm. And I think the skill of being a good clinician is being able to go through someone's history, having a look at going through someone's objective assessment and seeing what part of that load has been overloaded, and that then guides the rehab process. And then I think that, a good part of being a coach, a good coach and especially a good strength and conditioning coach, is being able to understand the influence of all those different types of load on injury risk and being able to manage them accordingly. So, when I go back to the day that I tore my ACL for the first time, the training load wasn't particularly high. The actual load on my knee wasn't particularly high, but I can remember that the indirect systemic load was quite high. I was very tired. I had had exams that week. I had poor sleep. And I was also training with a guy. So I was teaching a class. I was coaching. It was primarily juniors. But at the end, we were doing some conditioning work. So we were doing some bag work. And in Kyokushin Karate, we have this this drill or this piece of equipment which we call a big mitt, and it was named by the Japanese because it's big and it's a mitt, and I hate the name of it, but it's what a lot of our fighters use as their primary conditioning tool. It basically allows you to just use whatever combinations you want, so basically hitting this thing freely, so you're responding to the cues of a pad holder. You're basically just going going all out on this mitt, as you would with a heavy bag, but we tend to use it more so for stamina work. Because you've got someone holding it, you do have that that motivation from that other person. Anyway, the guy that was holding it wasn't holding it correctly. He was sort of holding it on his side. And what that did was make me annoyed and frustrated. So I was trying to correct the way that this guy was holding the mitt. and he was sort of not doing what I was asking, and that made me more and more frustrated. So we've got a state where, you know, psychologically there was an element of aggression and frustration, and then from an indirect systemic load perspective, you know, I was down on sleep, probably affected my, you know, my timing, my coordination, things like that, and that basically caused me to kick with a hyperextended knee and caused my ACL to rupture. And basically every example, every athlete that sort of comes to see me, I sort of look through that paradigm and see where there may be some loading issues and try and address it. Sometimes, you know, you may just be unlucky, you know, in the contact injuries, especially in combat sports, when you're, you know, dropping bombs on people, you know, shit happens. And you know, that's with any sport, you have those acute injuries that are sometimes difficult to prevent. But in other cases, we think that there's maybe a training error. So again, that direct systemic load, that overall training load may be causing fatigue, which then causes a fighter to not react as quickly as they should and throw something with you know, inaccurate technique and cause an acute injury to occur that way. Yeah, that sort of guides the way that I look at injury. And if I had that information, I think when I was, you know, coming up through you know, through my fighting career, yeah, I think that, you know, I'm not saying I would have necessarily prevented the injuries that I had, but, you know, I'd like to think that I may have reduced the risk and may have been better off. So, yeah, that's a roundabout way of answering your question, but I hope that sort of answers it.
Hey, guys, super quick interruption to the podcast to ask a super simple question. Are you sick of supplement companies selling you empty promises and products that are no better than fairy dust? I bet you are, and I'm sick of my clients forking out their hard-earned for it. That's why my colleagues and I created TrainAid, our very own line of a select number of lifestyle and performance supps that we know actually do something meaningful. We have used them with all of our clients from the stay-at-home mum to our UFC world champions. No gimmicks, no elaborate marketing ploy, just science. To find out more, be sure to follow TrainAid on Instagram and TrainAid Performance on Facebook. All right, back to the podcast.
No, for sure. And it's phenomenal, hey, because I often always think about that as well. It's like, well, what if we had that info? Or what would I tell my younger self? Or what would I tell these guys? And I think it kind of fills in why you get so passionate when you are coaching or you are working with other people, because you see, I didn't have access to this information, and I know what's going to happen if you don't have access to this information. And I'm just sitting back listening to you say that, and I'm thinking, wow, like, if you went to a gym and you presented a seminar on that, I could not think of one person who wouldn't have their ears, you know, really wide to that seminar. I'm just thinking, wow, what great information. It's so useful, but yeah, it may not have been around when you were going through, right?
Yeah, and I guess it actually came out of another interview that I did recently about injury management and rehab. And I was actually just thinking through this and trying to put the different facets together. And then I realized, you know, I should actually put this on paper and try and condense it and make it, somewhat more understandable. And I think it's a good way to teach, and I use it as a sort of teaching tool to other rehab and also as an education tool for fighters as well. I find it quite useful. Obviously, the language you use with it will differ depending on the population you're speaking to. But, I think that any example of an injury or even a lot of common performance issues can sort of come back to this system of management and the system of looking at things. I find it quite useful.
For sure, definitely. And speaking of educational tools, I want to start talking to you about your book, The Science of Striking. So this came out in 2018. Did you say that it was published?
2018. I got it wrapped up at the end by the end of the year there. I was sort of coming towards the end of my master's, and I had thought about writing a book for a long period of time. I felt that I had some unique perspectives, and there wasn't at that time. Things have changed a little bit now, which is fantastic to see. But at that time, there wasn't a lot out there in terms of physical preparation and S&C for combat sports. And I also felt that I, you know, wanted to give back to the martial arts community. You know, the practice of karate has given me so much. You know, it instilled a lot of values that I try and live by, you know, to this day. It gave me, you know, a lot of qualities, especially so self-discipline and perseverance, which I think that, you know, if I didn't have that, I may not have got through and got into physio and been successful in business and all the other stuff. You know, it gave me the opportunity to travel. It gave me that sort of impetus to come to Japan and, you know, end up having a great life out here and met my wife and kids and all that comes back to, yeah, to karate. And, you know, you say, my wife says, yeah, do you think you might not have met me otherwise? Do you not believe in fate? And it's like, oh, I find it hard to believe in anything without at least an RCT behind it. But no, it's so yeah, I felt like I wanted to give back. And throughout the journey, I'd seen a lot of things that could potentially be optimized in that training process, particularly within my style. And so, yeah, started putting some ideas on paper and thought that those ideas would come to life very quickly. And I quickly realized that it takes a lot of time and effort to put together a resource like that. I was telling you off air that I started writing, I think we came back from a holiday, summer holidays, sort of mid-2014. And my wife fell pregnant with our oldest son at the end of 2014. And I thought, all right, well, I'm not going to have too much time once he comes along. So I want to wrap this up by the middle of the next year. And ended up taking a little bit longer than I expected. But it was also just a project that grew and grew. And obviously my knowledge grew, as happens when you're working in the industry. And I felt like there was more and more bits that I could add to it. And more and more bits that I wanted to look into myself and put in the book. And then included the exercise library as well. So with the practice that we have here, we film a lot of our exercises and we have an app that we have our patients and athletes use. And so I thought that it would be good to put those exercises in the book. And there's a whole 100-page chapter just dedicated to, you know, progression and regression of exercise, which I think is one of the key tools, which is often underused within, you know, S&C and especially within combat sports. And so within that chapter, with each progression and regression, we have links via QR code and for the Kindle version with hyperlinks to YouTube clips. And there's about, I think, about 450 exercises in there. So I thought that would be good to put in. And I think that sort of stands alone as a good resource in itself, but combined with the rest of the book, it provides a framework regarding how to implement those exercises. So sort of wrapped that up towards the end of 2018. The writing process I really enjoyed. It was a lot of fun getting my thoughts out on paper. I don't think I'm a natural writer, but I felt like I sort of progressed as a writer. So, I mean, you could, if someone's reading the book, you may even notice a change in writing style from the start of the book to the finish of the book. Most of the pictures were of myself, and you can see me flow through about, you know, three different weight divisions throughout the course of the book, and a couple of different haircuts as well. As happens after you give birth to kids, there's often a fluctuation there. The editing process was a little bit harder than I expected, and that is probably the thing that would turn me off doing a project like that in the near future, just because that is quite a hard slog. But at the end of it, you know, I'm really proud that it's a resource that put a lot of, you know, my knowledge into, and I've had a lot of great feedback on it, and I'm hoping that there's people that are benefiting from it and getting something out of it and improving their performance and improving their health and hopefully longevity in their chosen combat sport.
Sam, this is going to be a tough question to ask, and I almost don't want to ask it because if someone asked me, I would roll my eyes and go, oh. But if there were a few major key learnings that you could summarize within the book as best as you can, what would you say?
I guess, you know, specificity is probably a term that gets thrown around a lot. But obviously in your world, everyone wants to know what the perfect diet is. And we know that that doesn't exist. And you need to assess an athlete and assess everything to do with them, and, you know, decide on what is the most appropriate diet for them. And I think that that underpins, I think, you know, everything we talk about in terms of strength and conditioning and injury prevention. And whilst, you know, if you're looking a lot at social media and you're following, you know, very smart people like yourself and all the you know, people that you've interviewed on your platforms, you know, at the highest level, I think there is a lot of specificity and, your top UFC athletes and your professional athletes probably do have a lot of specificity in their programming. When you take it back down to more of the amateur level, I think that doesn't exist. And I think that it can even be the opposite in that your amateur fighters may look at what's going on, look at what their favorite fighters might be doing and not really have any context of what's going on there. And I think that's a dangerous thing because, you know, the optimal program for Israel Adesanya is not likely to be the optimal program for you, for anyone else for that matter. But, you know, the most amateur athletes, and especially in the world that I'm coming from, is more, I guess, of a traditional martial arts, you know, people in white doggies that don't really have as much of that strength and conditioning sports science influence, it can be difficult. And I think that with a few simple tools, even at the lower levels, you can induce a certain amount of specificity to even an amateur athlete's training. So, you know, I hope that by going to a resource, not to push my own resource, but I feel like in my book, I try to explain in as much detail the relevance of certain assessments, where you would start with sort of baseline assessments, and then, you know, the things that you might want to do with a higher level athlete, or if, you know, you had your high technology that would allow you to assess to a greater detail. But, you know, sitting an athlete down and just doing a 5-10 minute range of motion assessment and then guiding your sort of flexibility and mobility interventions based on that can be really useful. So, you know, typically in your traditional martial arts class, and it probably happens in, you know, in MMA classes and in kickboxing, boxing as well, everyone will start with the same warm-up, and then at the end of the session, everyone will finish with the same stretches, and that, you know, does that routine might be perfect for one person in the class. It might be perfect for half the person in the class, people in the class, or it might be, you know, not really relevant for most people. And so by doing some basic assessments, finding out what an athlete actually needs, you can still, you know, train large groups of people, but adding in little bits of specificity here and there. And then, yeah, even with someone's, training systems within energy systems within a class environment. So often, you know, people are training at the same intensities regardless of where they are in their training process. And I think just having a bit of an understanding of some simple stuff around training intensity, you know, roughly what sort of energy systems you're using. Obviously, all the energy systems come into play together. It's not, you know, you don't go from, you know, alactic to lactic to aerobic, but, you know, having some sort of progression of intensity, I think, is important. And again, the top level, these guys are, are being analysed and having very specific training plans. But I feel that it falls off a cliff very quickly once you get past that high level. And I think that, you know, you're not expecting, intermediate level boxers to be, you know, being tested on force plates and indexes and things every week and having a high level assessment. But I think you still can add that specificity even at a lower level. And that is sort of one of the big hopes of the book as well. Obviously, that does create some issues in terms of scope of practice, because, you know, a skills coach isn't qualified, most of the time is not a qualified strength and conditioning coach. So, you know, you could argue that they shouldn't really be working with those sort of interventions, but every skills coach is anyway. Every skills coach is still throwing some sort of strength and conditioning, whether it is an energy systems work, which sort of works in with the skills work, or whether it's, you know, push-ups, sit-ups, squats, whatever they're doing, they will be doing some type of physical conditioning, physical preparation. So I think just adding a little bit more structure to that is not necessarily overstepping boundaries and working outside scope of practice. But yeah, that's probably one of the big takeaways is that element of specificity.
Yeah, that's absolutely brilliant. And I just, as you were talking then, I just had flashbacks of coaches upon coaches of us all doing the exact same warm-up and then doing our warm-down and then doing our conditioning, and we'd all do it, and then a quarter of the class would gas within a minute, and then half would be okay, and then there'd only be like, you know, a couple that would get through, or if they got through, you know, most people would be running for the bucket to throw up.
Yeah, and yeah, the one example that really sticks out with me is when I came out to Japan the second time. I was living in Fukuoka, sort of in Kyushu, which is another one of the smaller of the islands here. But basically, three times a week we had our fighter training in the morning, and we would start the session. And session order is again a thing which sometimes is done in the complete opposite order to how it's supposed to be done. But we would start off the session with this abdominal routine, which was done on a incline bench, and you would do, I can't even remember the specific order. I think it was just 50 full range sit-ups on the bench, and then you would flip around, hold on, and then do 50 leg raises. And then you would do 50 sit-ups, 50 leg raises, 50 sit-ups, 50 leg raises. And if you're not used to that, it was extremely difficult. So the first time I did it, I got there and, it was run through this, and all the Japanese guys I was training with were almost snickering. It's like, this guy's gonna be dead after he does this ab routine. And I was, and my form was terrible. I was just basically doing half a chin up to get my legs up. And the next day I could hardly move. It was painful to go to the toilet and to sit up out of bed because I was so sore. My back was sore. And then the next time I had to do this was 2 days later. And I had so much DOMS still that I wasn't able to do it properly. Anyway, I get to a couple of weeks later, and of course I'd adapted. And it's like, okay, cool, what do I do now? And they're like, oh, no, that's the routine. You do 50, 50, 50, 50, 50, 50, three sets, and that's it. And these guys had been doing it, for years. They've been doing this program for years. And, basically, it was a bit of a warm-up for them, and they would, joke and chat while they're doing their leg raises and sit-ups. And I thought, well, what's the fucking point? What, like I said before, I've lost that window of adaptation. I could have got the same adaptation probably by doing three sets of 10 of each of these exercises, but I killed myself doing 50, and now that's just what you do going forward. There's no sort of sense of progression. And I think that, again, with your martial arts classes, and all right, everybody down for push-ups, we're going to bang out 50. Okay, good. Well, John over here can do 100 push-ups easily, and then Fred at the back, he's been training 3 weeks, he can't even do one proper push-up, but we all have to do the push-ups before. And they might be like, if you stop, if you can't do any more, just rest for a couple of reps and then join back in and push it out. And that may be benefiting Fred, maybe not, because he's been pushed too hard. But John up here is not really getting any further adaptation. And apart from looking like a stud because he can do the push-ups really easy, what value is he getting out of that? And so I think that, a lot of the guys working with high-level athletes, it's probably not as relevant. But to try and create as many of those high-level athletes in the future, to try and bring up the whole level of combat sport, you do need to start at the ground up and in the grassroots, and just trying to be a little bit more intelligent with programming for more novice, intermediate, and amateur athletes.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Sam, just in the interest of time, I do want to ask you just the last question. If guys are listening here and they want to get all this great information, obviously this is all in the book, right, in The Science of Striking. This is all summed up in the book?
Yeah, I mean, most of it. The stuff that's not, I'm trying to get out on my website, my socials anyway. A lot of it, the basis is there in the book. And like I said, the way that you practice, I think we talked about this off air, if you take 4 years to write a book and you're still thinking exactly the same way over 4 years, then you're not really progressing as a practitioner. But I think the nuts and bolts of the way that I think and the way that I program is in there. And yeah, the stuff that I'm doing more now and trying to, you know, look a little bit more into the research around combat sports and not look a little bit more into it, but try and maybe summarize that and make it more accessible to people. I do try and get that up on my social media, mainly on my Instagram, which is The Science of Striking, one word. The book is The Science of Striking. It's available on Amazon in Kindle and paperback. And then the website, Science of Striking as well. I have a blog, which I try and get onto in some periods a little more frequently than others. And then I've also got sort of a training Excel sheet template on that site as well, which for nerdy people who like me that like numbers, that like putting things in spreadsheets and trying to track their training, which, you know, I think is a really important part of training load management, that's downloadable from the site as well. I understand that, you know, most a lot of people don't go to that level of specificity, and that's fine. And, you know, we can maybe talk another chat about, you know, the different levels that you can take it. I think that even sort of amateur and, you know, intermediate athletes should be recording their training and in some way recording that sort of objectively with numerical data and actually monitoring that in some way, which can be done fairly basic ways. But you can also do it in a lot more depth, and yeah, the sheets that I've got up on there sort of allow that. So yeah, that's where you can find me. Yeah, if you want to get in touch directly, DM via Instagram is probably the best way. And if you're ever in Tokyo, feel free to drop by Club 360, come to a training session and say good day.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Sam, thanks so much, mate. That's super informative, right? I'm going to go download it right now, to be honest, and I think that's fantastic. Could you just say one more time, Sam, before we go, if someone wanted to get in contact with you directly, because I've got a million and one questions going through my head right now, and I'm sure people listening will have as well. If they went, oh, crap, I've got to get on to Sam ASAP, is it best to go through Instagram, or is there an email they can send to, or through the website?
Yeah, Instagram, The Science of Striking, or thescienceofstriking@gmail.com.
Okay, fantastic. All right, well, Sam, thanks so much for coming on, mate. Really appreciate it. What a great episode.
It's been a pleasure. You're obviously a very busy man and a very busy week coming up for you. I think there's a lot of people envious that you're heading over to the island. I know it's all going to be hard work, but good luck. It's going to be an awesome card and very exciting time, and hopefully another title defense in the books. And I guess on behalf of all your listeners, thank you for doing what you're doing. I think the list of guests that you've had on is just incredible, and I think just the breadth and the diverse backgrounds of the people that you're having on has been great. And I know I've learned a lot just from listening to the episodes. You know, I would have never listened to like a whole podcast series on gut health, for example, if it wasn't, you know, from this combat sports introduction. So thank you for doing what you're doing. It's appreciated by the whole industry, and keep up the good work, and good luck for next week.
Mate, I appreciate it big time, because you know what, when I actually started the podcast, I didn't want to call it the Fight Science Podcast. But then I thought that exact same thing. I thought, would you sit down and just listen to another science podcast? And I said, no, you wouldn't. You'd never do that. You'd never put that on for your 5 or 10 or 15K run. You'd only listen to it if it was combat sports basis. So I appreciate it. It's all the guests. It's the guests. The guests make it great. And I'm glad you came on, Sam, because that was a really good episode. But no doubt we'll stay in touch, and I've got a million and one ideas after that chat that we can do in the future. But again, mate, thank you so much for taking the time.
Awesome. Thank you. Really enjoyed it.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Sam is a real thought leader when it comes to structuring training for combat sports. There are many great practical points in that episode, and I highly encourage all coaches to consider them for your athletes. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.